Okay, thanks Grant, and thanks for Stephen and Yvette for inviting me to this talk today. What I want to talk about is some of the work we're doing in the Southwest on adaptation for our freshwater ecosystems and what we might be able to do in terms of in-situ management.
Let me put on a slideshow, yeah, sorry mate.
I need my glasses, mate, you need to do it for me.
I've got the same problem, so.
Which is important.
Yeah, the hell are we? Yeah, I can make it easier for Wizard. Who's the presenter? Is oh, you're going to just press the.
Okay.
No, that's
not what we're doing. It's right down there. Yep. Yeah, that's it. Yeah. All right. Well, that's my talk. Thanks very much. I suppose my view is when we're managing river ecosystems, to me, we really need to know how they work. Now, knowing about species distribution is one thing, but to me, knowing how they actually respond to change, how they respond to climate shift, we need to know how these things are actually put together. So all the work we've been doing in our rivers is trying to figure out, you know, what are the sources of carbon which drives these ecosystems, and then how is that carbon distributed through the food web? So what's actually, who's eating what? So we're using a technique using stable isotopes. And how it actually works is different sources of carbon have different signatures which are passed on largely unchanged to the consumers. I suppose with a river, it can only really get its sources of carbon from two sources. Either it can import it from outside, from ecosystem across ecosystem boundaries, from leaves dropping in, say from the riparian, the stream side zone, or it can produce its own in terms of algae. But ultimately, you can only get those two sources of carbon which can drive these systems. If we look at the production of algae in our river systems, they're probably the lowest values we found anywhere in the world. And we think that's a consequence of the ancient history of the Southwest WA, the fact it's archaeozoic, it's 2 or 3 giga years old, it's been leached of nutrients. So we've got a really low nutrient ecosystem, there's not the nutrients to drive primary production. So inherently, levels of algal production are very low in these systems. I'd say the lowest we've ever measured anywhere in the world for similar types of systems. And what that means then is we think this system's almost entirely reliant on the import of carbon, totally reliant on riparian carbon dropping in from the streamside vegetation. This is just some stable isotope analysis showing here's the signature we get for riparian carbon, here's the signature we get from algal carbon, we overlie the animals and the fish, which I haven't shown, and almost always they overlie that riparian signal. So they're ultimately getting all their sources of carbon from that area. If we do the sums, it's about 90% of carbon in the bugs and the fish and the things that eat those in the rivers ultimately come from leaves dropping in from the riparian zone. So the most important thing we think we can do in terms of restoration is not worrying so much about the river itself, but putting a lot of our efforts on what's on the banks and doing a lot of restoration of, you know, fencing out, allowing plants to recruit. So that's the context, I suppose, of how we think these rivers work. This is the poster boy for climate shift. You've already seen this already. This series of step functions. We've had about a 20-25% reduction in rainfall, about a 40-50% reduction in inflows to our reservoirs, driest on record type of stuff. But what's that actually mean to our fauna? These reduction in total flows, what's it mean for our resident, you know, in endemic fauna? This is just a plot showing, this is just a series of sites showing permanent sites here and temporary sites here. All I want to show is they're different. So essentially, the permanent sites have all the interesting fauna. They have all the sort of ancient diabiotic fauna. We start shifting those into temporary sites. We get a shift into more sort of cosmopolitan, generalist-type fauna. Also, I won't get too much detail, but it's not only a total reduction in rainfall. We've seen a shift in the seasonality of rainfall. We've got less winter rainfall and associated shift into more sort of summer extreme rainfall. So what that means to our fauna is that they've lost some of these seasonal cues. A lot of our fish are reliant on some of those early or late winter cues, those little flushing flows, enabled to move upstream and spawn. So a shift in seasonality, we're going to see a loss of those seasonal cues. A shift into more sort of summer rainfall, we're going to see more water quality problems as we, you know, wash the manure in from the catchment with those extreme events. And as I've already said, we'll see a reduction in tidal flows, we'll see a shift in temporary systems. We'll have a local loss of some of our glomonic fauna, some of that really interesting ancient stuff. And when we start driving things temporary, it's a lot more difficult now for fish to recolonise because we've got a lot of barriers to migration. We've got dams and weirs in place. So once a river goes dry, it's really difficult for these things to get back in place. Also, we know that the important part of our rivers are the connected systems. Connectivity is really important. You know, linking the forest to the downstream system, we know the subsidy of carbon moves downstream. We'll have a reduction in these leakages. And also we know the riparian zone is the ultimate base of the food web, so we're going to see a a degradation of riparian zones through reduction in flows. We'll talk a little bit about temperature. Now, temperature typically has missed down on some of the arguments about stream ecosystems. It's good to hear some talks today saying how important we think it is. We've seen about a 0.6 rise in southwest WA, which sort of fits the global means. And what's happened elsewhere in the world, we've already heard a bit of this, is there's been a change in species distribution away from the hotter areas. And things like environmental lapse rates define how far a species has to move to get an associated change with temperature. And at sea level, species have to move about 145 kilometres away from the equator to have a 1 degree reduction in temperature. And if they're moving to higher altitudes, it's actually quite a rapid change. That's why we see such a sort of marked change in the distribution of plants. It's about a 6.5 degree reduction in temperature for every 1,000 metres you go up. So those lapse rates define how far a species has to move to get those associated changes to temperature. So what's that mean for us then? You're probably going to know where this is going to go. South coast of WA and important national parks are right on the very edge of the continent. So we start planning for a 2 degree rise. We have to shift. That's going to sort of stretch our resources a bit because it's going to drag the Fitzgerald National Park 200 k's out to sea. So the fact we can't do that means that we have to look at smart ways of trying to build biophysical envelopes in situ to look after our plants and animals. So I'm going to talk about now about how we actually might develop strategies for adaptation for in situ restoration of these systems. No, they can't move up mountains, we can't go further south, we're end of the world here, we can't keep off any further. So I'll talk about how we actually might build a biophysical envelope. And we'll talk a bit about how we actually might use temperature to guide some of these activities. You know, riparian vegetation does a lot of things, it has a lot of multiple uses. It provides the tribal material which drives these ecosystems, but also the shade keeps these rivers cool. This is just some modelling we've done. We can predict within less than a degree, just using simple measurements of bed materials and flows and local lateral event data. The blue line there shows across about a week period, that slide at the top there, I think it's Kidna Creek in southeastern Queensland, the sort of ranges of temperatures we get. Around 27, 21 at night. Quite marked changes between day and night and quite high temperatures. Now with our model we can take the rest of the vegetation away. Those are the black lines there, it's up to about 27, 28 degrees. But also with our model we can put some vegetation back in place. And that's the red line showing that temperatures have dropped significantly. They're around 20 degrees and a really small amplitude between day and night. So clearly riparian vegetation have a marked role in controlling water temperature. So what temperatures are we aiming for? You know, Australia used to be part of one wild land, that's when our fauna evolved. It used to be a lot further south than it is now. The continent's pushed north. We're pushing some of these animals into temperature regimes they haven't experienced before. So we did some lethal dose testing. It wasn't the happy index. We killed these guys. We found out what was a lethal dose for these things, essentially. And what we found was, for most of the bugs and the fish, around 21 degrees is when these things started dropping off. So that became our target temperature. So is 21 degrees realistic in terms of what we actually find in our river systems? Again, this is our model. We use the model in different parts of Australia, but essentially this model, what we've done here is we found a first order stream. With the model, we've taken all the vegetation away, then we've plotted temperature across a 12-month period. And hopefully what you can see is we use 21 degrees at our threshold level. Almost half the year, we take the vegetation away, the streams will exceed that threshold value, which we know is lethal for a lot of our fauna. This is just showing the same thing here, down where I'm from Albany, just surface plots showing across the 12 months a year, time of day, how much we actually exceed those threshold levels for our freshwater fauna. So these become our temperature thresholds. This is based on our lethal dose testing. We did it right from the temperate areas up to the tropics. And with our model, we figured out how much vegetation we need to get in place to maintain those rivers below that threshold level. Now, in our Perth, we need to get 20% shade in place to keep it below that 22.5 before we know the animals start tipping over. So, if we know that, then how do we actually be smart about restoration? Where in the catchment do we do it, and how much we actually have to put in place to optimise, you know, our restoration activities? Because the case is always we never get the whole catchment, of course. We just have to be smart about where we put it. Because things like latitude are clearly important. What we've done here, this is a natural program, what we've done here is those white bits on that plot there represent a stream. The black bits show the shade. It's So there's actually a fisheye lens taken upwards, 180 degree lens. So the blacks are shade and the yellow lines represent how the sun would track down the channel during given times of the year across a 12-month period. So you can see in the tropics, for a lot of the year, the sun tracks right down the channel of its east-west running creek, putting a maximum amount of heat and light into the system. Well, you move further south in the temperate areas, the sun moves more to the north. So the lesson there for us then is, in terms of restoration, if we only get one bank, which is often the case, the best we can do as we move further south is get the north bank, because that will give us the maximum amount of shade over these creeks. So latitude's important, and also clearly orientation's important. The east-west running creek, the sun's tracking down the channel most of the day, certain times of the year. When north-south running creek, the sun's on the top of the channel only certain times of the day, putting a lot less light and energy into the systems. So orientation's important. But also, shade can be provided by just the banks, topographic shade. So there's two things which determine the light input, which is the topography and local vegetation. So this is a guide to management we've come up in terms of how we actually might use some of this knowledge to optimise our restoration at the catchment scale to try to get the creeks below these threshold levels. The example I use here is a system we've actually worked in Tasmania, where that was the catchment we're interested in. So the first thing we did was just get an aerial photo just to map the existing vegetation into ordinal classes. In this case, we just used three classes. This is a 10-minute job. Based on the aerial photo, how much vegetation is already in place at a catchment scale. Next thing we got was a digital elevation model, which is just showing the local topography. And that digital elevation model, we ran a solar radiation algorithm through it, and all this really shows is how much light hits each of those pixels in that catchment based on the topography for the DEM. And then we used GIS to work out how much light actually hits the creek, because that's what we're interested in. Then we put those two things together. So we've got our vegetation mapping, how much vegetation is in place, and we've got our radiation mapping showing, based on that topography, that orientation, how much light's hitting each of those pixels in their catchment. We put those two things together to get a priority map. Another thing what you can see is the high priorities of restoration have become the top part of the catchment, and those east-west running creeks. This really differs to what a lot of our restoration activities have actually been in Australia. Typically there's a town down here on a fifth water street. We plant a few trees here and have very little impact because clearly the system's vulnerable to what's happening upstream. So this is really a change in how we thought about how we optimise our restoration activities. So east-west, north bank, top of the catchment, and then work our way down. There might be cases where we do put some vegetation in place. I'm going to protect the habitat, say, of examples in Queensland looking after Mary River Cod. We're trying to keep some cold water inputs from the main channel, so there might be more targeted restoration. But typically this is the model. Start at the top, work your way down. So we start using information for climate shift. We start projecting out for a 2-degree rise by 2050. We think the way to do it is actually, what we call zonal restoration. These are our existing targets at the moment. We need about a 10% increase in riparian vegetation for every 1-degree rise, as a rule of thumb. So we start projecting out for a 2-degree rise by 2050. We need to get about a 90% shade in our creeks around the rivers around Perth to keep the animals below that that threshold level. Okay. Finish with just a couple of slides. I think some of the important stuff with NCARF is probably be how the different disciplines link. What we're trying to do at a catchment scale clearly could link in what the terrestrial people are trying to do. Repairing zones are highly productive areas, the corridors. That's not fake, that was actually a photo. water in Australia. We also know that riparian zones are refugial habitats and nursery habitats. We also think there could be carbon transfer and aquatic back out to the terrestrial where the river's actually feeding parts of the terrestrial environment as well. This is my last slide, just a summary. Our important biodiversity national parks, the only biodiversity hotspot in Australia is on the extreme south coast, so the hottest part of it is. There's no elevation, so we have to build an in-situ biophysical envelope. We have to start thinking about over-restoration where the temperature target's going to change. So, as I said, a 10% increase in restoration will be 1-degree rise. There's some limitations, modelling limitations up to 2050. We're not sure what temperatures we're going to aim for. We put more vegetation in place. We're thinking about the water use by that vegetation and also the temperature tolerances of the actual vegetation we do put in place. Some of the dryandras and banksias we know are quite sensitive to temperature. We can build refuge, we have to be careful. We don't build refuge which are coffins or zoos. In the rivers, we have to make sure they're connected. It's no good just having a single spot refuge. These have to be be a highly connected system grid, so I have to have a way to link it through. We think there's going to be multiple benefits from repair and restoration back to terrestrial ecosystems. We're playing now with how we actually do some patch and scale offsets between repair and restoration and environmental flows, you know, releases from dams to keep those temperatures right. In southwest Alberta, we're looking at the triage, essentially. We can restore the restorable. Some stuff we actually have to actively sacrifice, we can't do much about it. So being sensitive about what we actually, which systems we actually do protect. I think the other important thing is looking after other environmental insults. You know, the levers we pull for secondary salinization might be different from the levers we pull for managing rivers for climate shift. Just knowing which are the most important things which are actually determining the health of our rivers. I'll leave it there.